Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest is Ilya Shapiro. Ilya is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. Previously, he was executive director and senior lecturer at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. He's written several books, including the forthcoming Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, and in 2020, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. He holds a bachelor's degree from Princeton and a master's from London School of Economics and a JD from University of Chicago Law School. Ilya and I have a conversation about several of the most controversial issues in law and American society today, many of which are playing out every day right before us. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Ilya Shapiro, welcome. Thanks for joining.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
I want to jump in with, we have so many things to talk about, and they seem to be always related to the law. But the first one I want to mention is the question of presidential illness, an incapacitated president, and the hypothetical. I think this is one of the most worrisome things to me, and yet it doesn't seem to get a lot of traction in the news, is that we can't have a country if we are run by a president who's incapacitated, and that's arguable. But in a hypothetical, even in the most extreme case of a dead president, I'm wondering from this vantage point the question, is it a crime to cover that up by people who know? And if it's not a crime, I don't understand how it couldn't be, but how is it constitutionally somehow a clear problem?
Well, I guess we could talk to the ghost of Edith Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's wife, who purportedly executed his functions when he was largely incapacitated after a stroke in his second term. I don't know if it's a crime. Any actions taken by someone who's not the president, acting without his express authority, would not be constitutional. So anyone who's hurt by some executive action would have standing to sue. I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the criminal code, so I don't know what someone like that would be charged with, but certainly obstruction of justice in certain cases that might be attendant to those kinds of suits, or if Congress disagrees with what the president is doing, you could have all sorts of disputes and indeed ultimately lead to a constitutional crisis because there is no law in that area, and yet we sense that something's wrong and that the background principles of the way the government's supposed to operate are violated, but specifically whether someone could get charged for that, I'm not sure.
What about the idea of, is that, again, this is all hypothetical, is it an impeachable offense for people who are impeachable to have covered that up? I find it very troubling that the discussion, and let's just, be obvious here, about President Biden and his cognitive status, it seems to be about the politics of running as a candidate rather than running the country. And that's very worrisome to me as a citizen. This is not even a political statement at all. And I'm wondering, it's obvious to me, as it is to most people, that there's a problem here with cognitive status, yet it was denied or covered up. And I wonder, is this impeachable? And I'm sure it's not specifically called out in the Constitution, but you're the constitutional expert here. Is that something that there's a remedy for in the Constitution? I mean, we have had, like you started to mention the precedent or the history of Woodrow Wilson. But to me, this is more a sort of analogous to what happens in places like the USSR.
Right. Well, Neil Ferguson and Jonah Goldberg have been having that back and forth about whether America is now the late gerontocratic USSR. And it is and it isn't. I think the analogy is useful up to a point, not beyond a point. But is it impeachable? You know, anything is potentially impeachable. It's a political remedy. You can be impeached for something that's not a crime. Arguably, not all crimes are impeachable. You know, Ulysses Grant, this came up during the legal debate over Trump's official immunity, the case that the Supreme Court just decided. Ulysses Grant was pulled over and given a citation for speeding in his horse and buggy back in the day. That's a criminal violation of some sort, probably not impeachable, almost certainly not impeachable. Conversely, a serious breach of the trust of the public, misleading the public over something as important as the capacity of the president, to me, that does seem impeachable. But of course, who can you impeach? You could impeach the vice president, who's in on the cover-up. You could impeach other Senate-confirmed executive officers. You can't impeach, you know, just a political appointee. Can't impeach the first lady, things like that. You know, as I just hope our conversation here isn't overtaken by events. The last, as we're recording this, the last 10 days or so has compressed, you know, several years of news cycles within itself with a once-in-a-lifetime event happening every few days. So I'm sure there will be more developments in this regard, and there will turn to the conversation of whether President Biden indeed can continue in office for the 6 months that he has left.
Right. You touched on presidential immunity, and this was a lot going on, of course, in the court system about this. I'd like to sort of have you educate me and the listeners what the argument is and what the courts have so far sort of decided about this concept.
Well, this is a case that the Supreme Court would rather not have had to decide. John Roberts, especially the Chief Justice, does not enjoy having to insert his court and the institution of the judiciary, for that matter, in political fights, in politicized lawfare, and all of the other things that have been going on. But the D.C. Circuit, the court from which the appeal came, wrote such a broad ruling, essentially saying that presidents can always be prosecuted, and, you know, those prosecutions might be thrown out if there's nothing to them. And I don't think that's right, because you can have rogue prosecutors doing lots of different things against presidents of the opposing party, or to create mischief or make a name for themselves or what have you. Imagine Alvin Bragg, if he was a rather than the Manhattan DA, if he was a U.S. attorney or something like that. And so the court, once you recognize that, then what the court ultimately decided is pretty much what one would expect. That is, certain things the president can't be prosecuted for, things that the Constitution explicitly and exclusively delegates to the president, his role as commander-in-chief, the appointment of ambassadors, all of those core executive functions. And there are certain things that the president is not acting as a president, and everyone agrees, including, in this case, Donald Trump's lawyers, when he's acting as a private citizen, or as the head of the party, or as a candidate for office. So I liken that distinction to you can't be prosecuted for sending in drones to kill someone abroad. This came up with President Obama, for example. But you can be prosecuted. The president can be prosecuted for shooting someone on Fifth Avenue, the famous thing that Trump said a number of years ago.
But then this is this is in or out of office, really. I mean, this is, it doesn't seem like there's a distinction here between while you're actually president and being a former president, because it's the same sort of thinking. Am I correct?
Well, when we're talking about official acts, and I'm about to get to that big middle gray area where the rubber meets the road and where all of the discussion about Trump, I think, is headed. A non-president, a past president, can't commit official acts. So, for example, the other case against him, this immunity case came out of the January 6th related or post-election machination-related indictment in federal court in D.C., but he's also under indictment for mishandling and keeping classified records at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, and that's as a past as a post-president. Nobody's arguing that there can be some sort of immunity there. It's a different issue, and you know, Judge Cannon down there said that Jack Smith was improperly appointed, which is a completely separate issue, but is related to a short concurrence that Justice Thomas wrote in the official immunity case. But getting back to that three-partite, the tripartite division of conception of immunity, so there are core executive responsibilities or exclusive executive powers under the Constitution. There's acting as a private citizen or leader of a party candidate, non-president, and there's things in the middle. Could be official acts, presumption that there's immunity for these official acts, but it's for courts to look at on a case-by-case, fact-by-fact basis. So, for example, talking to the Attorney General or others in the Justice Department, that's within the executive branch, probably immune, because that's the exercising authority over the executive branch. What about talking to Mike Pence on January 6th? The vice president is part of the executive branch, of course, but in the Capitol, he was acting as the president of the Senate. And so that's an Article I. That's a legislative branch capacity. Again, lower courts will have to figure that out. And then talking to, when Trump talked to legislators in Arizona, Georgia, other places, well, presidents have no authority over state legislators. So that, even though he might be doing an official act, probably no immunity for that. But again, the Supreme Court didn't decide that. They just said, we're just sketching out how you might look at this middle area and sent all of that back to the lower courts to decide. It was remarkable, Scott, actually, how much wiggle room Chief Justice Roberts's opinion left, how many of the terms were vague or how many ambiguities were there. And I think that's on purpose because John Roberts is one of the best lawyers in the country. He knows how to be precise with his language. He's one of the best legal writers in the country. And so if there's some wiggle room there, if there's ambiguity, I think more likely than not, it's you know, he didn't want to box the court in, either this court with respect to Trump, as that saga continues, or future courts with future presidents and prosecutions. And I'll add one more thing on this. And that's that I think it's unfortunate that Roberts' immunity framing ultimately won the day, as opposed to Amy Coney Barrett, her concurrence. She agreed with Roberts, but basically saying, well, the other side of the same coin is to reframe the same idea, but talking not in the sense of immunity, but in whether it's constitutional to apply a particular criminal statute to the president in a particular case. That, I think, if it had been framed that way, a lot of these things would have seemed less controversial, because then we can think about, well, can Congress criminalize the president doing this or doing that, or, you know, when he's acting as a private citizen?
I sort of also wonder, extrapolating from that, what about people suing for what happened during the pandemic? And so here I'm getting at things, again, I'm naive to this. I don't know, have any legal knowledge. I'll admit that. So I'm wondering about people suing because of things like, whether it's presidential or not, the government mandating experimental drugs, vaccine, or closing businesses, arresting people for these sort of quote, violations of those edicts, causing people to lose their jobs because they didn't do X or Y, including taking the COVID vaccine, for instance. Are these potential lawsuits not necessarily, you know, perhaps to the executive branch, but even other governments? Is this sort of thing going to start happening now? Because people did lose their jobs. People did... you know, you could even make the case about governmental orders of, say, Governor Cuomo or other governors, Pennsylvania, California did similar things, New Jersey, of allowing COVID-positive patients into nursing homes. And people may or may not have died from that. Are these things going to start piling up in the courts?
Well, I think they did during the pandemic. A lot of them were dismissed either for sovereign immunity or ripeness or mootness or all sorts of kind of procedural barriers.
And the reason I'm bringing it up now is a newer topic is because, you know, although a lot of people will never admit it, the facts are the facts. And I think there's a lot more to that. These edicts were not based on any kind of science whatsoever. And in fact, they were wrong. And the lockdowns destroyed and killed people, for instance. The school closures, all the data on children, long-lasting damage. I mean, what is there no remedy for that in the sort of courts?
I can't give you a general answer to that, and that's maybe why people don't like lawyers, because just as you were riffing through the various kinds of hypotheticals, I'm thinking, well, that would be in multiple different court systems under so many different kinds of theories. What would the defenses be? I mean, you have to look at each one by one. So you can make claims that the person lacked power to issue that particular edict. I remember there was a case in Wisconsin where a particular lockdown order was indeed invalidated because under state administrative law, their health authority didn't follow the proper rules or hadn't been given the power to do what it purported to do. At the federal level, you know, we saw the Supreme Court turn back President Biden's vaccine mandate. So there are different things that were successful, some that weren't, you know, other kinds of cases raising religious liberty claims, which is a different kind of claim than saying you don't have the power to do it. There are federalism claims saying, well, the federal government can't do that, but states might be able to order that. And then there are civil suits. You know, I lost my business.
Right. Getting at. The damages from these things, the personal damages.
The bar for suing government actors in their official capacities, I mean, to get at them in their personal capacities is somewhat different, requires kind of malicious proof of malicious motives and things like this. But in their official capacities, there's a sovereign immunity bar unless the government is acting as a commercial actor. So let's say it sets up a competing business to yours or something like that. That's a different sort of situation. But you would be talking in the federal context. There are the Federal Claims Act litigated in the Federal Court of Claims in Washington, appealed to the federal circuit. At the state level, there are similar such things. Generally don't succeed unless there are just very, your business is particularly targeted, or again, the government went beyond its power and hurt all businesses and you can have a class action. It's a very complicated sort of situation. And when there's invocations of emergencies, some of these rules are lessened further and the bar to recovery is even greater. So,
I mean, this is what, in my view, I think one of the biggest problems during the pandemic was the ambiguity and the lack of boundary on what is an emergency. Because when you declare an emergency, it is the gateway to doing anything. Now here I'm speaking again without a real legal basis. I'm just saying.
No.
My impression.
What might not surprise you is that emergency is nowhere defined in the Emergency Act, in the Federal Emergency Act. What that legislation does is when the president declares an emergency, and there are similar things in each state, that triggers certain authorities in over 1,000 statutes. Nobody knows exactly how many, but over 1,000 statutes. We were familiar, for example, with the Defense Production Act, that you can require companies to produce, personal protective equipment, for example, or ventilators. Now, it's not a taking. You're not, seizing their company and you still pay them at market rates as determined by various regulations. But you can require them to produce that rather than some other consumer goods or something like that. That's a high-profile one that was actually triggered. And there are other things like that. But there's no definition of emergency. And that's a problem because you can have, as we discovered during COVID, especially as time went on, there's a difference between a serious situation, a critical situation, and an emergency. It's kind of like the difference between when you have cancer and when you have a gunshot wound, right? Both very serious, important, critical medical situations, but you generally don't go to the ER to treat your cancer.
I mean, the practical issue, and there are many, is that the emergency use authorization for a drug that's experimental, that was developed in an expedited fashion without necessarily the same safety profile. For instance, vaccines often take close to 10 years to prove safety and efficacy, using medical jargon. You know, if you say emergency use authorization, a lot of these things are off the table, all the safeguards, really. And of course, in a true emergency, you can argue that that's reasonable. But that's the question, is it was never defined. There is no limit
to an emergency. And then there's a difference between authorizing the vaccine and mandating its use.
That's a separate,
right. And then there's the cover-up of the claim that not only will it help you not get COVID or have the effects of COVID be milder, but it'll prevent transmission, which we learned very quickly was not the case. The compelling interest of the government to do something changes based on the facts on the ground. There's a lot of impropriety there. And Scott, as a lawyer, but as a practical realist, I can tell you that a lot of people just want to forget about it because it was such an ugly period in our history, recent history, of course. But and it's, kind of this attitude about no use crying over spilled milk, or I don't want to revisit it. Very similar, actually, from what I've read, to the Spanish influenza pandemic of 100 years earlier, where we sort of, killed many, many more people, and especially, not the very young and the very old, but people in the primes of their lives. It was more devastating than the COVID pandemic, and yet was forgotten about very, very quickly as we roared into the 20s, as it were. Very little written about at that point. Few policy changes that were kind of trying to learn the lessons of the pandemic. I think we're repeating history in that sense, just because of human nature.
Well, human nature, and this is the, I hate to be dramatic, but to me, it's the immoral, unethical side of human nature, because A, we live in an ethical society, and people need to know the truth, especially after everything they've been through. But secondly, there's a sense of accountability, and that accountability must occur, or these same people will do this again, in my view. You could say anything's an emergency, and maybe certain things are emergencies and certain things are arguable, but I could see various forms of the general term lockdown being used for climate change, being used for all kinds of things. And the issue isn't, should that happen in this context? The issue is, we need to make sure that there are real constraints, particularly in a country that was founded on the basis of limited government and individual freedom. And I think, this is this lack of closure as another reason. We cannot have closure as a society, in my view, until there is an admission that everything that was done with lockdowns and school closures was wrong. And it failed and harmed people, many in this lower socioeconomic groups. I mean, this kind of ethical violation of our social contract, and using our children as shields, forcing them to be, injected with an experimental drug. There are so many things, and I don't want to spend the time going through COVID, but I think, in my view, we need to keep demanding reality, exploring what happened, and if for no other reason than to prevent it from happening again.
Well, Scott, I think you're talking about something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or something like that, and I'd be happy to co-author with you and Jay Bhattacharya or whoever would be appropriate, an op-ed calling for that or something. The problem is, so many people were involved in it. I don't just mean the government officials.
No.
I mean popular support. And of course, that changed over the course of the pandemic. Popular opinion was different in March 2020 than July of that year, than December, than the fall, you know, et cetera. You know, it ebbed and flowed, and we heard about these variants of the virus and whatnot. And different states, of course, pursued different policies. So most of the action on COVID, other than rhetorically speaking, was not at the presidential level either by
Absolutely.
Trump or by Biden. And so you had, you know, when we talk about the vaccine mandate, that wasn't a federal thing other than the short-lived and blocked by the federal courts Biden vaccine mandate for the private sector. And for example, I mean, there are lots, but again, most of the action was at the state level, and we had federalism in action that way, which is in a sense bizarre because, or states might have different preferences or policy preferences about, you know, the optimal rate of income tax, but they shouldn't, you know, all people are the same biologically, viruses affect them the same way. Why did we have this difference? And I think that's where policy over such massive disruptive things as a once-in-a-century pandemic really shows differences in people's values and how they balance risk and freedom and equality and all of these different values.
But I think it really boils down to there were a lot of things here, including the influence of the of totally incompetent bureaucrats advising and influencing not just the country but the world. And I'm talking about Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci and others. It's a complex topic, but I think the common theme to me is that we live in a free society, okay? And I think we have to be very, very cautious, extremely cautious, about overriding individual freedom for any reason.